This is going to be a talk about park architecture, National Park Service, rustic architecture, which got called park architecture, and Fred Wilson's contribution to it. When I first started talking about it, thinking about parkitecture, it's one of those things. When Potter Stewart, a Supreme Court justice, was looking up or trying to understand obscenity, he said, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. I feel the same thing about park architecture. Not that it's obscene, but I just know when I see it. See if this works. These are the National Park before the National Park Service, the ones above the line are National Park Service. 1872, Yellowstone became the first national park, but Yosemite in 1864 became the first state park. So we certainly weren't the first park. And we go on down here, and all these other parks were developed with architecture and generally by the railroads. Yellowstone was served by the Union Pacific, the Northern Pacific, the Burlington Northern, and the Milwaukee. And this is one of the posters by the Union Pacific about Yellowstone in the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco in 1915. The interesting thing about this is the main building, you probably all recognize, is the Old Faithful Inn. It was made by the Northern Pacific, which I thought was kind of interesting. The Union Pacific used it in this exposition. This is a drawing of that exposition, probably worked off of a photograph. There's a fairly large pavilion you could walk into with a miniaturized Old Faithful Inn. When the park first came into being in 1872, there was very little money for it. In fact, the money that was available was cut. And in 1886, Philip Sheridan, who was a Civil War general, moved troops into Yellowstone Park and saved it. Before that time, you could go into the park, build hotel, any kind of hotel you wanted. You could poach animals. You could serve your guests with wild game gotten from the park. And it was just it was not being taken care of. So the Army did save the park. Without that, it would have just deteriorated markedly. But the first buildings in the park were just utilitarian 1880s style buildings. This is Fort, it became Fort Yellowstone. It was Fort Sheridan at first. And most of the other buildings in the park were very similar, just utilitarian buildings, nothing to speak of. This is, of course, at Mammoth. This is eventually what Fort Yellowstone became. If you've been to Mammoth, you've probably seen that. Beautiful buildings. I'm glad they saved them. The Army was there until 1916 when the Park Service came into being. In 1885, this is another one of the buildings in Yellowstone. In 1895, this is the mail carrier's cabin. So as you come, you leave Gardner, you drive up the road, just as you enter the two-lane highway, two-lane street, or the split street going into into Mammoth, on your left, you'll see this cabin. It still is there. And this mail carrier would pick up the mail at the train station. At the time, it came into Cinnabar, which is where Corwin Hot Springs is right now. And it was 8 miles from the park. That railroad came to that spot in 1883. This man would drive down or ride a horse down there, pick up the mail, and take it to Cook City. There was a thought of eventually of putting a rail service into Cook City, but that never happened. This is another one of the buildings in the park. It still hasn't become park architecture, 1903. Keep in mind, the Park Service came into being in 1916, so there were things taking place in the park at that time. This is a beautiful building, but it doesn't say park architecture. But park architecture was starting all across the country. This is the LeConte Memorial Lodge, designed by Bernard Maybeck. He was an architectural professor at UC Berkeley. And he's starting to use natural stone. And this is the very first start of park architecture. Park architecture cannot be defined as one style of architecture. And we'll get to that in a second here. For instance, overlooking the Grand Canyon, the Santa Fe Railroad opened up the Grand Canyon, and they wanted architecture to fit their area. So I always thought that park architecture was this alpine-looking architecture. But park architecture was not, because this fit the area. So these were the early expressions of what would become park architecture. And of course, as far as I'm concerned, and most people, the granddaddy of them all, is the Old Faithful Inn. This really started setting the tone for the alpine park architecture. So where did park architecture start? That was the tough part, because it never started at any given spot. It started in Europe. This is from the 18th century. This is an old house in Germany. It's got half-beam construction with wattle and daub in between it. It still looks somewhat like it could be an early route of park architecture. Keep in mind there is no route that park architecture took. This is a house, a little cottage on a lake in England, 1839, and you can see some elements there of park architecture. But what's happening in this country at the time were things like the Wedding Cake House. That's in Kennebunkport, Maine. I've never been there, but it looks pretty fabulous to me. This is a Gothic architecture. And that's about gaudy, I don't know which you really want to say. That's about as far gone as you can go. That's truly an amazing thing. But other things that are taking place, the Victorian era brought in architecture. And this was this is a mansion from Northern California, Eureka, California. And that's what was being done at the time with Victorian-type architecture or Queen Anne architecture. At that time that we're talking, around the turn of the century, the sailing ships were being replaced with steamships. And so people could go across the ocean much easier. And the people from the Northeast, or any wealthy people, almost all took their vacations to Europe. So they went to Europe, and they brought the architecture back that they saw. And this is a wonderful drawing of a German chalet. So park architecture reaches from Scandinavia all the way down into the Alps, the park architecture we're talking about. This is one of the great camps in the Adirondacks. This is Vanderbilt Camp. And you can see it's almost a direct descendant from the chalet that we saw earlier. So the great camps in the Adirondacks started bringing back these ideas from Europe and building their camps. They added, most of us know about the Adirondack furniture, the Adirondack style. So it started in the great camps in the Northeast. Here's a boathouse from that same area in the Saranac Lake in New York State. But park architecture was also taking place in the West. This is a beautiful example of another Maybeck building in southwest Lake Tahoe. And Maybeck was exploring the use of natural stones. This is called Glen Springs Resort, I believe. And I just happened to that. That's near the Desolation Wilderness. And there are a whole bunch of buildings like that. And I was hiking into the wilderness, not expecting to find something like this. And I ran into a whole enclave of buildings like that. Beautiful stuff, as far as I'm concerned. Another architect, brothers out of Pasadena, California, were the Green and Green brothers. And they really started popularizing bungalows. And they were not looking to the east, they were looking to the west, toward Japan. They were looking at what was happening in Japan. There was a real attraction to Japan about 1910 or so And so they started developing bungalow style. And it all kind of came together at the Coronado Hotel in San Diego. And not because it's anything park architecture-like, but that's where these two men met each other. Harry Child was born in San Francisco. You can see in 1857, he started the San Francisco Stock Exchange. He moved to Montana in the 1880s, and he became the Yellowstone Park Association. He bought into the Yellowstone Park Association, and they were a group that were the concessionaires and the transportation people in the park. At the same time, Robert Reamer was born in Ohio. He was merely a draftsman. He came out at 21, started working in the Coronado Hotel to do some of their work for them. And they met at one point. And they met when Reamer was 21 years old in 1901. And they liked each other, and they started getting along. And they came back, and one of the first projects he did for the Northern Pacific Railway was the Old Faithful Inn. There's a quote here that I really liked. It was written by a newspaper man, and Reamer was noted for drinking a little bit too much. And he's saying of this plan, it was sketched from the plans while coming shakily out of a monumental submersion in malt. And some claim to be able to read that fact in its unique contours. So there's always somebody with an attitude. At the time, since Harry Child was involved in the Yellowstone Park Association, they started expanding into all kinds of other things. In 1903, the Northern Pacific made the final 8 miles from Cinnabar into the park. Before that time, they were having trouble buying the land, and they had to have to run stages from here into the park. Robert Reamer designed the Northern Pacific train station in the park. Right now, the the arch is there, but the Gardner High School is right here, and the archives for the Yellowstone Park is right here. Okay, it's over here. Wait. Well, it's right, the old one, the new one's right there. So this has been torn down. Robert Reamer also designed the W.A. Hall store, and he was working on some designs for the arch under Hiram Chittenden. And Hiram Chittenden was an engineer, and they fought back and forth, and I don't know exactly who got the final design for the arch, but as soon as Chittenden died, Reamer took credit for it. We like that part. At the same time, 1903, Robert Reamer remodeled the Lake Hotel. He added these porticos. There was a hotel there before. He added these porticos, and people would come in on their stages, stay in the hotels. And that's quite an elegant structure today. But there was a movement by the railroads to see America first. That included the Santa Fe, that included the Great Northern, the Northern Pacific. And they put on this program to see America first. So suddenly people started coming to the park. And they would come into Gardner, get on a coach, go into the park, enjoy the park. And here's a Yellowstone Park poster for the Union Pacific from the 1920s. Beautiful stuff. The Union Pacific came into West Yellowstone. The Northern Pacific came into Gardner and Mammoth. The Burlington had a minor effect. They came in through Cody, and the Milwaukee came in through Three Forks. This is another building that Robert Reamer did, and I included it because, once again, it's hearkening back to the false half-beam construction. But the most significant part about this is that it burned in 1925, and a lot of the artifacts and documents for the park up to that time were lost. So where does Fred Wilson come in on this? Fred Wilson's in the top left-hand corner there. Going back to his parents, his family, his mother moved out here in 1869. His father had moved here in 1867. He went back, married her, and brought her out in 1869. But they had an early connection to the park, because in their little cabin, which is where the parking lot of the First Security Bank is, they hosted the Doan, Washburn, and Langford party in 1870 before they came down to Yellowstone Park to explore it. So there was a direct connection there. Fred was born in 1877, so he's 4 years younger than Robert Reamer. He went to school here. He was born, of course, here in Bozeman. He went to school here, started at Montana Agricultural College, eventually transferred to Columbia, and then came back, worked for a while in Helena, then he went to Europe. So he's playing a baguette. So once again, they were the gentry. He went to Europe. It's always said that he studied at École de Beaux-Arts in Paris, but he really didn't. I checked into that. He was there from 1904 to 1906, only part of 1904 and part of 1906. Most of the time he was there, he was traveling around Europe, absorbing the architecture. And that's really important to his eventual career, because he developed this incredible vocabulary about architecture. And he became a little bit tired of Beaux-Arts. He was originally intrigued by the Bohemians and all this sort of stuff. But at one point on one of his trips, he came back from traveling, I believe this time to Germany, and Beaux-Arts was having a parade in downtown Paris. And he was disgusted by the nudity. So had a bunch of naked Bohemians, I guess. In 1910, he left. He worked in Butte. He ran the office of Link and Hare Architects in Butte. In 1910, he left there and he built his first commission was Hamilton Hall here on Montana State campus. But that same year, he did Sacagawea Inn in Three Forks. Now, the Milwaukee had come through Three Forks a couple of years before that, and the old town of Three Forks was about a mile northeast. And this hotel right here, this wing of this hotel, sat in that other town, but when the Milwaukee decided this was going to be their division point, they cut the hotel in half, and half of it is one wing and the other half is the other wing. So if you ever get out here and look at it, this is Fred Wilson's, but that predates Fred Wilson's work by quite a bit. And the reason I'm bringing this up, it sounds like I'm jumping around, I probably am, is that the Milwaukee came through here, and eventually they would pick people up in a stage, they'd go down the Gallant Canyon, and they were using the Gallant Canyon as their entry to the park. Eventually, they did the Gallant Gateway Inn, and they were able to leave there and cut the travel into the park. At the same time, Robert Reamer was still busy, still building park architecture. Once again, park architecture had not been defined yet. 1910, he did the Grand Canyon Hotel. Beautiful hotel. It was torn down in the 1940s, 1950s, I think. Maybe a little bit later. 59. But one of the most significant things that took place was in 1915, when automobiles were admitted to the park. And there's an edict to how machines could be permitted. Machines were not permitted to exceed 12 miles an hour ascending hills and 10 miles an hour descending hills. On straightaways, with no teams of horses within 200 yards, the machines were permitted to operate up to 20 miles an hour. And on curves, the speed limit was 8 miles an hour. And motorists were learned that due to the elevation of the park, the power of the machines was sharply reduced, and about 50% more gasoline was likely to be used. But the one thing that these automobiles did is it allowed the everyday people to get into the park. It wasn't just relegated to the very wealthy. And because of that, they created tent camps. These tent camps are really, really cool. There's one of the tents. It would be canvas from here up, be a shingled roof, and lumber from there down. And there's the inside of it. So that's glamping. That's glamping for sure, right? So what was happening here is there were two places that people could stay in the park. They could stay in those tent camps, or they could stay in the hotels. And the wealthy people stayed in the hotels. And this porte cochere has been added. Originally, it was just a portico here with columns. This porte cochere has been added. And you can see the park buses delivering people here about, well, this is right after the cars were admitted, 1915. But the most important thing is that. That's the stagecoach that's been abandoned there on the side. So about 1916, the Park Service came into being. Before that, the Army was running the show, luckily, because we wouldn't have much of a park left if they weren't there. And this is the taken about 1916 when the handover started taking place. It took 2 years for the handover to take place. The interesting thing here is this guy right here. This is Second Lieutenant Jonathan Wainwright. And if you know anything about your World War II history, he was left behind when MacArthur left the Philippines, and he was taken prisoner of war. He was a general at the time, and he spent the entire war in the prisoner of war camp throughout the Japanese Empire. But to see him at this point, I thought it was always kind of quite interesting. So the Army can't leave anywhere without some sort of ceremony. So this is the last cannon fired in 1918. But the Park Service is already, there was a handover taking place to the Park Service. And that's 1917, but they had to decide on what kind of uniforms they're going to wear. So they just keyed directly off the military uniforms. And that's a button from one of the uniforms. And in 1918, Charles Punctured was appointed the landscape architect for the park. He was a really important figure. He was appointed in 1918 partially because he had a lung condition that wouldn't allow him to be inducted into the military during the First World War. And so he took over this job. For 2 years, he traveled around to parks all around that were available, and he learned about the architecture of the parks. And unfortunately, in 1920, he died. But by that time, he had set up what park architecture was going to be. And he didn't define it perfectly well. He just defined it for himself. For himself, he said, he is a small fine arts commission in himself, for all the plans and concessioners must submit to him for approval as to the architecture and location before they can be constructed. So he didn't define, he didn't say it had to be like this, he didn't have to say it had to be like that, but it had to go over it through his desk. Daniel Hall took over after that. That might be a little bit hard to read up there. It says, an important job harmonizing the park construction with park atmosphere is up to Daniel R. Hall, National Park Architecture and Landscape Man. So he was an understudy to Punchard. So he picked up on the same thing. The whole thing was park architecture. They wanted it to use elements from nature. And it was said by a historian who was studying this years later, I'll read you this quote, that park architecture was when a building became an accessory of nature. So that's about as well defined as ever was. It was never any more well defined than that. And Hall did this. This still stands. This is the Lake Ranger Station. It was designed, like I said, by Hall. And it was they wanted it to look like a trapper's cabin. So that once again, it goes back to the history of the park. So 1919, Fred finally, as far as I can tell, he got his first commission in the park. This is the Lake Lodge. And I just found that out fairly recently. And what is happening is there were the hotels and there were the lodges. And the hotels were for the wealthy, and the lodges were developed for the common everyday person. So these lodges were put where those tent camps were initially, and then the tent camps were replaced by cabins. And their lodges were supposed to be more rustic. You're supposed to get a more rustic feel there. This is the Lake Lodge lobby. Unpeeled logs, simple furniture. This is the Mammoth Lodge dining room. Once again, unpeeled logs. Looks like Adirondack tiles, chairs, and such there. This building is long gone. And this is the Lake Hotel. So that gives you an idea of the difference between what was happening. If you stayed at the lodge, you would stay in a cabin, and you would go into this rustic environment. And the Lake Hotel was, if you wanted a more elegant environment. So Fred also designed cabins. He would design a one-room cabin or a two-place cabin or eventually a cabin with a bath or without a bath. And these cabins were used all over the park. So he didn't necessarily design something for one location or another. These are at Fishing Bridge, and they're badly in need of, well, they're probably going to be torn down. They're really rough shape. But it gives you an idea of what the cabins replace the tents. It continued on. Fred never got any of the really, really choice projects. This is the Madison Junction Museum, and it was by others. At that time, the Park Service was out of San Francisco. Eventually, it moved to Los Angeles. And the architects who got all the plum buildings were closer to the purse strings, as usual, I suppose. This is the Yellowstone Park transportation building that replaced the one that would burn down. Once again, this is an Art Deco building, but Fred didn't get that. If you go through Gardner and you go through the arch, you go around one way. If you go in front of this, which is a restricted road, back here there's some horizontal warehouses. That's the kind of stuff Fred was picking up at the time. There's Fred Wilson about 1927. That's a 1927 Essex, if you're interested. He always had a cigar. He could never smoke it at home, but he would smoke it whenever he had a chance. He always had a bow tie. I found a picture of him as probably an 8-year-old boy. And there's his brother dressed up just, you know, dirty and muddy and like a boy. And Fred had a polka dot shirt and a bow tie. He always had a bow tie. This is another building that's there, built 1926. This is the boathouse just down the shore from the Lake Hotel. The Lake Hotel would be back here. If you went to the shoreline and went west, you'd find this. It's pretty much the original condition. Some things have taken place, but that's also pretty rough condition. So a lot of these are falling apart. But a lot of his best work took place outside the park. Fred, I think, really liked park architecture. He initially just said, architecture is a public service. So if you came to him, and as you get to know more of Fred Wilson's buildings, and I'm sure you're all eager to do that, you'll find out that he did everything, he did every conceivable style. And one thing I think he really liked was park architecture. This is at the Spanish Creek Flats. Was at the Spanish Creek Flats. Right before you get to there, you could go up to Ted Turner's land and in the Spanish Lakes. And so these are redwood logs. Milwaukee Railroad, welcome to Gallant Gateway. Gallant Gateway, of course, is named Salesville at the time. When the Milwaukee took it over, they thought, okay, this isn't good enough. They renamed it Gallant Gateway. Sales was gone. This is an interesting juxtaposition. It took Fred's drawing out of perspective, moved it over next to the river, increased the height of the cliffs, and then threw Milwaukee on here. This arch stayed there until World War II. And the big trucks going up and down the canyon road couldn't get underneath there very well. So that went away at that time. The Milwaukee improved the Canyon Road at that time, too. Another building, not very exciting. This is the Recreation Center at Old Faithful. Old Faithful would be on that side. Old Faithful Inn would be way over there. And the Old Faithful Lodge would be behind this. So it doesn't look very interesting until you go inside it. I think it's a beautiful building inside. This is for recreation of the people working in the park. And so if you ever happen to be down there, the doors are sometimes unlocked and sometimes you can get in there. I did. He did the Rock Haven Chapel for the Presbyterian Church. That's just inside the park. And the drawing is up here if you'd like to see one of the drawings. Once again, it's a park architecture style. And Fred was not, once again, he was not getting the great buildings in the park. He was having to express himself outside the park. In contrast to what was happening here, he did this the same year. So that's quite a contrast between one another. Most architects don't play that vocabulary quite as much. This one I just love. This is the Stewart store. This is Highway 191 right here. This is the crossroads that if he turned to the left, he'd go into Yellowstone Park. If he turned to the right, he could end up going to Idaho. The Stewart store, the Stewarts and the Eagles started out together, but at one point they split up. The Stewart store is right across the street from the Eagles. And this does look like the Old Faithful Inn, miniaturized Old Faithful Inn. Unfortunately, it's no longer there. And, of course, the Eagle store, which is still there. So if you're, and right here is Highway 191, and you take a right-hand turn, a left-hand turn, and you go into the park right here, or the Stewart store would be right across the street. This building started out with this wing, and these were added later. If you ever get to the park, if you ever get to Eagle Store, you have to go in there and get a chocolate malt. It's a real chocolate malt with that green chocolate grinder with malt powder and chocolate ice cream and everything. And you may pay $5 for it, but it's a lost art. This is a sketch that he did of that building. So you can see Fred's sketches were competent, but they weren't outstanding. But they did what they had to do. But his magic really took place when he started drawing these up. This is a section, of course, so you can see part of the roof, and it's a section cut through there. So this is the Eagle store. The other thing that Fred did on this particular store, he did it for free. He did the whole drawing for free. Maybe to the consternation of his wife, because she thought he should be making more money than he was. That was always something that they were discussing. He also, this is the cabin at the Diamond J Ranch. And that's between Ennis and Big Sky on Jack Creek. And it's a dude ranch. And I haven't been able to get in there yet because they take the winters off. But I want to get in there and start seeing what Fred did inside there. So if you ever get up there, if you leave Ennis, you go through Jeffers, then you head toward Big Sky, and just there's a gate that keeps all of us commoners outside of Big Sky. And before you get to the gate, you'll look off to the south, or to the north, left side of the road, and the Diamond J Ranch is there. He did the band shell in Bozeman. Once again, this is park architecture, but it isn't in the park. He's just keying off of that. And to show you the contrast between his park architecture, this is 1938, and 1933, 5 years before, he did the Graff Mansion. So quite a difference. I'm not showing this to show you off your park architecture trail, but I just wanted to introduce that. So 1943, there were 62,000 visits to the park. 1950, there were 1,111,000, 18 times the number of people coming to the park. During the war, the park was, all the money was being shunted to the war. The park was just falling apart. And after the war, before the war, there was the Depression, so very few people had much money to do anything. After the war, there was this whole resurgence in the United States, and people bought cars, and they started traveling around a little bit more. So things had to change. The park had to adjust to that. And at that time, park superintendent Conrad Wirth said, within the limitations of the fundamental objectives of the National Park Service to protect and serve, the lid is off. He went on to say in 1955, he instituted a project called Mission 66. So in 1956, they were talking about 10 years hence, this is what we need. And one of the things he said is, be imaginative in considering all problems and to the end that these ideas may be produced and are worthy of adoption. He also went on to say, bring something effective in achieving the twin objectives of protection and optimal use. This is a drawing in 1956, or maybe 55, 56, of a small dormitory in Canyon Village by Fred. I would have to say it's kind of an uninspired drawing, but that was what was happening. There were shortages after the war, so the construction had to change. The other thing is when you're building, hand building a structure with a lot of ornamentation, it's expensive. And I have just recently read an article in the 1956 Colliers talking about Ozzie Berg, who followed Fred. They overlapped for a very short period of time. And they both made a design for the Lutheran Church there on Olive. And Ozzie Berg's was modern, and it was cost half the price that Fred's would have cost. So that was another consideration to get these things. But Fred went on still to do some real masterpieces. I consider this just an incredible forever masterpiece, the Soldier's Chapel. It was done for Nelson Story the Fourth. He was called Fourthy, who was killed during the war. He was a member of the 163rd Infantry, and this chapel is dedicated to him and the members of the infantry. If you've never been there, this is a fabulous building. It's perfect in every way, as far as I'm concerned. So 1956, August 56, Fred Wilson died. And I've talked to his grandson, and they said, we didn't know he's sick. And he left behind a huge legacy of all kinds of buildings. He was a man without an ego. He just did whatever you wanted, whatever your budget would call for. And I thought it was really quite interesting that he took that position, the subordinate position in Yellowstone Park, and expanded it and really celebrated it outside the park. I keep hoping that I would find some really fabulous building in the park that he did, and I can't find anything yet. By the way, the in the back, there's set up on two easels, there's the drawings of the Rockhaven Chapel and a small drawing of the Lake Lodge, and then some blueprints of they called it a plunge, a swimming pool, and a bathhouse in Fishing Bridge, but I've never found a photograph of that, so therefore, it didn't show up in the slideshow. That's all I have.